Thank you. I appreciate it. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Look at that. First time. You guys are learning. Some of you are slower than others, but I appreciate the fact that you're responding quickly this morning. So as Pastor Don just said, we're in the middle of our series for the month of June, the also known as series or AKA series. And we're taking a look at people who are mentioned in the Bible, but may not be a very common name that you'd recognize. Somebody who's not one of the bigger names that we see. So if you were here, you can think back. If not, our series here online, you can actually catch up with them if you would like to later on, gc3.org. But if you remember back a couple weeks ago when we kicked off this series, does anybody remember who Pastor Don talked about? Og, right? OG, the giant killer, right? Last week, Aaron spoke on another gentleman, Jehu. Right, Jehu the what? Madman. See, you guys are actually learning. That's what I'm all about. So today we're going to actually talk about somebody that's probably going to catch a lot of you off guard. Today we're going to talk about JL the Terminator. It's a real cool name, right, for Father's Day? Right, we're talking about Terminator. It's really cool. But here's the problem. You're probably thinking, for those of you who know who this person is, a little bit of an odd choice for Father's Day. Because why are we not picking a strong man to talk about for Father's Day? Or heck, even a man? Because the reality is JL is a woman. And so for Father's Day, we're speaking about a woman. So why are we speaking about a woman? Because when I tried to decide, PD gave me a list of people to pick who we were going to talk about. I said, you know what? I'm going to go with her. And why do I want to go with her? Because she embodies exactly what most men desire to be, or maybe what we should strive to be, okay? She is actually, in her moment, one of the baddest women you will ever meet, okay? So for all the fathers in this room, thank you for raising strong women. Because without a strong woman like her, the story may not have continued on. So before we get really deep into this, I want to talk about a simple phrase that we still use to this day. Anybody ever heard the phrase, the right place at the right time? Right? We know this. Anybody here lived in the right place at the right time? Okay? We've all been there. So in history, as we look back, there have been a lot of these moments. So I'm just going to cover a few real quick. Let's see if you guys can figure this out. First one. Anybody ever heard of a guy named Zheng Zhu? Anybody? Yes, I stumped you. Okay, that was my goal today. So looking at the picture here, you can probably suspect Zheng Zhu was an ordinary 6th century Chinese farmer who, while planting his crops, accidentally struck a buried 2,000-year-old artifact from China. You ever heard of the Terracotta Warriors? This is our guy. While planting, I was going to say corn, but I don't know if they plant corn. Whatever he was planting, rice, right? I don't think he was planting rice in a field like that. So while planting whatever he was planting, digging in the earth, bang, he strikes one of these. What would you think if you struck one of those? Uh-oh. I'm with you, George. I'd be like, uh-oh. What did I just do, right? So in his moment, right place, right time, he uncovered one of the world's most fascinating archaeological finds of Chinese history. Okay, next guy. Ever heard of a guy named Alexander Fleming? Yeah, a couple of you have, right? What's he known for? Penicillin. So Alexander Fleming was a scientist who was studying bacteria. His wife said he had to go on vacation, so they left. Through the vacation, they come home. He's eager to get home. Goes right to the lab, starts looking at his bacterial samples that he's studying. And he realizes they're all bad. They're covered with mold. So the most of us in this room would be like, wasted, throw it in the trash. I know that's what I would do. Moldy. Not him. He looked at the samples and saw that the areas where the mold was growing there were no bacteria. It was killing it off. Hence, through his fascination, he discovered penicillin, thus saving millions of lives. I'm sorry for the people that are allergic to it, but he still saved millions of lives, okay? Next guy, you ready? Actually, it's not even a guy. We're going to talk about a woman, okay? Anybody ever heard of Rosa Parks? Okay, very, very common. Obviously, we know who she is, woman who was just on her way home from work, a long, hard day's work, and this might be one of the most pivotal moments of the American Civil Rights Movement today. She is known for being at the right place at the right time. I'm sure at the moment it didn't feel like the right place. It may have actually felt like the wrong place, but inherently now we know she was at the right place. Ready. For sports people, anybody know the name Jim Boeheim? No? Anybody know Jim Boeheim? All right, Colin, thank you. Thank you. See, we got a couple in here in the room. Jim Boeheim, coach for the Syracuse men's basketball team. He actually was a walk-on player for Syracuse basketball, and a coaching vacancy came available. Some crazy reason he applied for it, not many other people did, and they said, you know what, we'll take a chance on you. He becomes the head coach. Guy ends up coaching for 47 years, wins a national title in men's basketball, and wins over 1,000 games total. If he hadn't been at the right place at the right time, we may not know who Jim Boeheim is. Okay, next guy. Anybody ever heard of Tank Man? Unfortunately, there are plenty of people who seem to think they know his name. Nobody actually seems to know this gentleman's name. We're not even sure he actually still even exists. Does anybody remember this picture? Okay. 1989, Tiananmen Square, the start of the Chinese political movement, right? Civil rights movement. Again, this is a world-famous picture by a world-famous photographer. This guy is standing in front of the tanks defying the big Chinese government. Right place, right time. And then finally, I got one more for you. Anybody ever heard of the name Rick Rascorla? Anybody? Yes, I stumped you again. That's what I was going for. Rick was a Vietnam veteran who was actually a director of security for Morgan Stanley on September 11th, 2001. For the kids in here, you may or may not know what September 11th, 2001 means. I think if you're over the age of about 25, you probably got a pretty good hint. On that day, World Trade Centers were attacked. Planes were flown into them. And the New York Port Authority asked everybody inside the towers after they were hit with planes to stay put. Okay? They didn't know what to do. They panicked. Stay put. Rick, through his years of service and through his smart thinking and wisdom, defied the Port Authority. Defied him. That day, he helped 2,700 people evacuate from the World Trade Center. 2,700. He saved lives because he was in the right place at the right time. Ultimately, Rick lost his life when the towers collapsed. But without him, 2,700 more people more than likely would not have come home. So as you can see, some of these moments are really historical. Some of them get me emotional. And there are some immense moments of bravery that we just talked about. So what does this all have to do with the woman that I'm going to speak about today, JL? Okay? The phrase, the right place at the right time, embodies exactly who she is. But none of it becomes even remotely possible without God. Okay? He used a chain of events to bring her to the moment she is known for and to place her exactly where he needed her when he needed her. So again, last week, if you were here, Aaron spoke on Jehu the madman. We're going to go to the story of Jael. And when we look at the time frame, the story of Jael happens much earlier than the story of Jehu, okay? When we talked about Jehu last week, we were already into Israel having kings in place. And he's going to fight. This is prior to all of that. So I'm going to take you on a time warp. We're going to jump clear back to a guy I think most of us know here, a guy by the name of Moses. Pretty familiar with him, right? Moses is the guy who led Israel out of Egypt after captivity of 400 years. Once they escape Egypt, they wander around the desert for how many years? Okay. And then Moses takes them right to the edge of the promised land and says, this is going to be ours. And then God says, hold up. Moses, you're not going in. I don't know about you guys, but I would feel like, man, I was put here for that moment. And then God said, hold up. You've got us this far, but this one isn't for you. Okay? At that point, Moses dies, and Joshua is appointed as the next leader of Israel. Through a series of battles, Joshua takes the 12 tribes and leads them into the promised land, where they conquer it from the Canaanites. Although they had managed to take the land, they did not do as the Lord had commanded them. It wasn't enough to just take the property. The Lord had commanded them to drive out the entire nation of Canaan. Why did he do this? He did it so that Israel didn't have to contend with the influence of the Canaanites. He did not want Israel to be subjected to their sinful and corrupted ways. Instead of doing what the Lord said, Israel doubled down, and they did not wipe out the nation of Canaan. Instead, they moved in alongside of them. And not only did they move in alongside of them, they adopted their own ways. They adopted their sinful nature. They took on their rituals, and they took on their gods. How do you think this made God feel? I'd have been disappointed, right? I gave you two commands. Take the land, wipe everybody out. You didn't do it. So what does this do? This starts a cycle for Israel. And if anybody spent some time in the Bible, you realize this in the Old Testament. Things get really good or prosperous, right? And then when Israel decides they're full of themselves enough, God slaps them down. And then they go back into a cycle of ruin. And eventually, Israel finds themselves actually being ruled over by the very people they were told to eradicate, the Canaanites. God brought you here out of Egypt. You wandered around for a bit so we could thin the herd and get rid of all the old guard. You were told to wipe them out. You moved in next door. You took on their customs. And now we have a problem because now they're back ruling you again. Would have been easier if you'd have just listened the first time. But clearly, they didn't. So what does God do? God raises up a series of judges. And when you and I hear the word judge, we think about a guy or a gal in a nice black robe that sits behind the tall bench. And we hear people argue cases, and then we make rulings, or we issue rulings, or we make sentencing, and any of that kind of stuff. That's not what judges did back then. That's not who they were. Judges back then were typically tribal leaders. And as a tribal leader, yes, they heard arguments, and yes, they issued rulings, but they were the people who were basically leading the country at that point. Okay? So once a judge was put into place, things would go a little bit better when they decided to get a backbone and they would fight against the Canaanites. Things would go a little bit better. And then there would be a period of peace and freedom. And then eventually, as we see through Scripture, they would slip back into their old ways. I don't know about you, but personally, I know I have moments where I do really, really good. And then I have moments where I slip back to maybe some old bad habits, right? Or some old bad ways. And then usually my wife kicks me in the butt and I straighten back up for a bit, okay? And then eventually I'll slide back. So we're not much different than Israel, correct? We really aren't. So what we see here is a pattern, and maybe you've heard this little phrase or these terms. Through these judges, we see this cycle of rinse, wash, and repeat. And it happens over and over and over. But if you look at the much bigger picture, the problem is each one of these judges gets more corrupt and more corrupt and more corrupt. And we read in Judges 17:6, we read this verse. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. This verse sums up the entire book. As a matter of fact, it's in as simple a terms as it can get. People did what they want, when they want, how they wanted. And they liked it. And you know what? It sums up the book of Judges so stinking well that they repeat it again at the end of the book. So in Judges 21:25, we read that same verse again. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. Now, I don't know about you, but what if we all just did what we wanted when we wanted? Be a little chaotic, wouldn't it? Be a little crazy? Some people might even be offended, right? So today we're going to start in chapter 4 of Judges. And in chapter 4, we're going to enter the period where we read about the third judge listed in the book. And this third judge, again, is a female. Anybody ever heard of the judge Deborah? Okay? Deborah. She is Israel's first female judge and Israel's only female judge. So here we again are again on Father's Day talking about another woman. Sorry, guys. But anybody ever heard the phrase, behind every strong man is a stronger woman? There we are, right? Deborah wasn't immune from what happened with Israel of this process and cycle of good, bad, good, bad, good, bad. So once again, Israel is doing what is evil in the Lord's eyes. So God decided to give Israel over to the king of the Canaanites. The guy's name is Jabin. Jabin was fierce, and this guy had amassed an army that was bigger than most people could even fathom. And this army was commanded by a gentleman named Sisera. Sisera. Sisera was not the kind of guy that would back down from a fight, which I think becomes really easy if you have this giant army behind you, right? If you're standing in the room by yourself, you got to be a really tough guy to want to stand there and fight everybody. But when you got a giant army, it'll make you macho real quick. But Sisera had been in charge of that army for 20 years, and he was not good to the Israelites. He was cruel, and he was torturesome, and he used intimidation to keep control of them. So in Judges 4:4-7, I'm not going to read all this scripture to you. You guys can read it if it pops up. Go back and read it later. We'll hit some key things that we really need to read, but I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. So in Judges 4:4-7, we see Deborah summon a man by the name of Barak. Not that Barak. Okay? Different gentleman. And this guy was the guy that God had revealed to Deborah to call to lead the Israelite army in a fight against the Canaanites. And he is called to raise up 10,000 warriors and prepare to go to battle with Sisera and all of Jabin's army. Deborah, through her conversation with God, proceeds to tell Barak, listen, you're going to win and you're going to be successful. And you're going to defeat the entire army of Jabin. But Barak didn't have the same confidence that Deborah had. You see, Barak was the guy who sat back, thought about it for a bit, and was like, yeah, I don't know if we can do this. They got a lot of guys and a lot of equipment, and I got a bunch of untrained soldiers who don't know how to do things. Okay? So Barak responds to Deborah with a charge that really changes the history here of the direction they're going. And in Judges 4:8, he says, there it is. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. Barak had a hesitancy with him. And he didn't think that Israel could defeat that army. And he didn't think that he could defeat Sisera. And in some instances, it really feels like him going to Deborah and saying this, listen, I'll do it if you come along, but if you don't come along, I'm not in. Him saying that is like, you know what? If the ship's going to go down, the captain's going with it. It's not just going to be on me. We're going to take everybody out at the top. What he didn't expect was Deborah to say, I'll go. I'm in. And then she turns to him and says, you know what? God has revealed to us or revealed to me that we're going to be successful here and that Sisera is going to be defeated. But you know what? Because you had a hesitancy about you and you weren't confident in the fact that God was going to provide for you, you're not going to get the glory. It will not be you that kills Sisera. We're going to give that glory to a woman. A woman named Jael. Okay? He didn't have any clue who the woman was. He just knew that Deborah said it wasn't going to be him. So before the battle had even begun, Sisera does something to try to intimidate the Israelites. He calls up 9,000 iron chariots and his entire army. How much? All of them, right? 900 chariots and all of this army. He calls them all up. He's not going to lose this battle. He is for once and all going to put an end to Israel. He's done. But what he doesn't count on is the fact that God is with them. Okay? So he collects his people and he marched from Harosheth Haggoyim to the Kishon River. It's a big word. There's not a quiz later. You don't got to panic about it, okay? But all the chariots and all the men, they couldn't handle it. God was on Israel's side. And he was going to make sure that this battle was handed over to them. So as they fought and the losses really started to mount, we see something happen that's kind of ironic. Sisera abandons his chariot and he flees. What would you think if your leader saw you getting your butt kicked and didn't fight harder but packed your stuff and left? That'd make you want to fight a little harder with him, wouldn't it? No, it kind of changes it, doesn't it? It changes everything. Like, holy cow. Here, Barak wants Deborah to go fight with him. And then we see Sisera counting the losses, and he's like, I'm out. I got to save my own neck. I'm going to save my own skin here. So he escapes, and he flees on foot. But what he doesn't realize, he's fleeing right into his own demise. Okay? So Sisera fled to a nearby land where a gentleman named Heber the Kenite lived. And there had been a pact between Heber and King Jabin to keep things calm between them. And this led Sisera, as he's fleeing that direction, to believe that it was safe and secure when he reached that area. There was a pact in place. He knew them. It was going to be good. All would be good. They would help take care of him. So when he arrived at Heber's tent, Heber's wife Jael stepped out. Now, If you saw an army commander headed your way and you knew there was a big battle, it would be really easy to say, I don't want any of this. Not my tent. Go find another tent. But not Jael. Jael invited him in. She said, come on in. Brings him in. Okay? He's tired. He's weary. He's exhausted from the battle. He's probably hungry, thirsty. So what does she do? She invites him in. She gives him a blanket. Probably an Afghan, let's be honest. Thanks for laughing at that. Gives him a blanket, and he says, man, I'm really thirsty. Can I get a drink of water? And she doesn't give him water. She gives him milk instead. Back then, getting a drink of milk was like hitting the honeypot, like way better than water. So she gives him a drink of milk. And Sisera falls asleep. His belly's full. He feels safe. He's got a warm blanket on. This guy falls asleep, okay? As he's sound asleep, Jael goes over and picks up a peg for the tent stake and walks over and with a mallet places it over his temple and drives it right through his head. Happy Father's Day. There's your gore, okay? There it is. One fell swoop drives it clean through his head. Okay? Kills him. Done. Dead as a doornail. Okay? You can read more about it if you want the rest of the details in Judges 4, 18 to 21. But ultimately, this fulfilled the prophecy that Deborah had spoke about in Judges 4, 9. That Barak was not going to get the glory of killing Sisera. This would be fulfilled by a woman. Pretty powerful, right? So what makes Jael so important, and what can we learn from this woman? She's barely mentioned in the Bible. She gets a little blip in Judges. So what makes her so important? When I examine this story, man, there are a lot of biblical truths here and a lot of lessons. But there is one that I really want to point out. Just one. It's all I want you to take home today. Just one. And that is God places us in the right place for the right time. So how is it that a woman who is not an Israelite, who may or may not have followed God, was living in a land away from the rest of her people, would become the perfect person to defeat this commander of this giant army, which would then in turn lead to the collapse of the Canaanites? So let's start by looking at who Jael is, okay? Jael means, her name means mountain goat. Don't laugh, okay, don't laugh. We're not talking about her physical appearance, although I really haven't seen a picture of her. Maybe she does look like that. But we're talking about her characteristics, right? Her character. And so anybody here ever seen mountain goats? Yeah? They're beautiful, aren't they? They are beautiful in the wild. So when you observe mountain goats, there's a couple of things I want you to take away. Number one, they're tough. They are tough animals, okay? Number two, they're steady. They are steady. Look at that thing standing on that rock. They are steady. And number three, they are built for rough terrain or conditions. Mountain goats don't live posh lives. They don't get a little pen and somebody brings them a cup of food every day and you don't get to pet them. Or like those fainting goats, you don't get to clap your hand and they fall over. They're not cute like that, okay? It's not who they are. So when we look at mountain goats, her name is a mountain goat. Jael is that kind of person. So the situation God used Jael in required many of these same traits that we see from her name, okay? She had to skillfully navigate a very, very rough situation. If she doesn't end successfully with what she's getting ready to do, what happens? She's dead, right? And we know it. She had to skillfully navigate a very rough situation. She had to be steady. You think she picked the stake up or the peg up and was like, yeah, let's go do it. Nah, I better do it. She couldn't do that, right? What if she woke the guy up? It all ends, right? And finally, she had to be tough. She had to be tough enough at the moment to do what God had her do. It was a tough task to carry out driving that peg into the enemy. So again, why did God choose somebody who wasn't an Israelite? So let's see if we can connect some dots for you here, so you can see why God picked Jael and how he used multiple events leading up to this moment in the tent to show that. So Jael and her husband, if you caught this earlier, were from a tribe called the Kenites. Not Israelites, Kenites. Kenites originated from a man named Jethro. Anybody ever heard of Jethro? Few of us have, right? Not the Beverly Hillbillies, come on. I got you. Don't think I can't hear you out there, okay? So the Kenites originated from a man named Jethro. You may or may not remember him as the father-in-law of Moses. So back to Moses, okay? He was a priest, and he raised his sons and their families to believe, trust, and follow in the Lord. Now, we're many generations later, so we don't know if that fell off or not, but we know that there was that common bond. The Kenites were friends with the tribe of Judah. So when Israel entered into the promised land, the Kenites came alongside of them. And to not be in the way, they went all the way to the southern border of Israel, and they stayed right on the edge of the wilderness. That was their place. They were going to live in harmony down there with the tribe of Judah way down. Okay? But Heber and his wife, they didn't stay down there. I don't know what happened. Did they have a family falling out? Did they decide they wanted to move to the big city? I don't know what happened, but they did not stay down there. They moved way back up north near where this battle was going to take place, southwest of the Sea of Galilee, okay? That is where they're at. Because they're foreigners living in a land that is not theirs, this is why they struck the pact with Jabin. It was a bit of self-preservation. It was a bit of safety, a security net built in when they struck this pact with him. Now, what did that pact look like? I don't know. Scripture doesn't give me the details. There's no signatures on it. There's no date stamp on it. And there's definitely not a notary stamped on it. I don't know. But there was a pact there, and we do know that, okay? It is very, very likely then, because they would have had to have met the king in order to strike this pact. It is very, very likely that Heber, his wife Jael, Sisera, and King Jabin more than likely all knew each other. When you enter into a contract with somebody, you like to have all parties involved there. And if Sisera is going to enforce it, why would he not be there? Very, very likely that they all knew each other. So what really started to appear as though God chose a random woman to do this really doesn't end up being as random anymore when we look, okay? She was in the right place at the right time, and she was right where God needed her to be. So what does this look like for us? So like Heber and Jael, God has placed us all in the right place at the right time. You may not believe this, but it really is true. He has placed us all to be in the right place at the right time. Think about it. The family you're in, the community where you live, the school or workplace that you're part of, even your peer group that you run with. None of these are accidental. None of them. Every one of them is an intentional spot where God needed you. Remember the peg that JL used to drive through his head? I'm not talking about the instrument of death, and I'm not talking about you should go whack somebody in the head, okay? I want you to think about this, though. This week, I want you to sit down, and I want you to think about those four groups that I just listed, okay? Family, community, school or work, and your peer group. And on the back of your paper, I believe there are four boxes already on there. If you don't have a paper, it's fine. You can make a mental note or make a note in your app. You can pick this up later, okay? So I want you to think about those four groups. And I want you to think about a couple of names for each of those groups. And these names I want you to write down are people who either need to know the Lord or need to grow in the Lord. And then I want you to take the peg and I want you to peg them. I'm not talking about killing them. I'm not talking about driving a stake through their head, okay? I'm not talking about whacking them in the head. What we're talking about when I talk about the peg is simply the instrument that God used because of JL's devotion and the strategy that he gave her to help the Israelites. You combine that with her ability and her great zeal, the difference she made, definitely in Sisera's head, right? He made a huge difference in his head. But broader than that, the difference in the lives of the people that she knew around her, the people that she lived with, the people that God wanted to reach, and even the people for the last 2,000 years who have received her story and heard her story. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to use the letters from the word peg, and I want you to think about strategically serving God and being an instrument of change in these people's lives that you just wrote down. Listen, you don't have to write them down today. You can do it this week. If you want to do it now, but whatever, okay? So we're going to use the letters from PEG. We're going to use PEG as an acronym to get to this point. Ready? P. I want you to pray for God to open their heart and mind. So these people you are thinking of, these people you're going to write down, I want you to pray for God to open their heart and mind. Listen, I got a couple of guys over the last, I would say, 5 to 7 years who I know do not have a relationship with God. I know based on discussion, I know based on actions, I know based on lifestyle. And I'm not judging, it's evident. You hang around enough people, you feel it, you see it, you know it. And these guys are still my friends. They're still my friends, most days. Most days. The reality is, I am praying for them constantly. I am praying that God will touch their lives. I'm praying that God will open their hearts. And I'm praying that God will begin to change them. Now, some of this is really, really difficult because I want things to be really easy. I want them to just wake up one morning and be like, man, I really need God today. I just need God today. But I can tell you for at least one of them, it wasn't that easy. It wasn't that easy. And it took him losing his wife to start asking questions. It wasn't easy. So when you're praying for people, don't assume it's always going to be easy. And you're probably going to get dragged through the mud with them for a little bit. And they're going to ask questions. And you're going to feel the pressure to answer questions for them. But you know what? Keep praying. And you don't have to answer every question. It's okay to say, I don't know. But pray for them. That's where it starts. Okay? The second letter of PEG is an E. And you're going to engage them in conversation that goes below the surface. Nice weather today. How's your week? Did I learn anything about you? No, because I already knew what the weather was. I could guess based on how you were acting, how your week was. It was either good or bad. But I don't know why it was good or bad. It doesn't do it, right? It just doesn't solve the problem. So, Jackie and I and Denny and Kelly all lead a home group. Okay? We have a home group with a bunch of young adults. You ever tried to talk to young adults? Some days are really easy because the weather is good. Other days are not. But when we sit down at the table, I try to ask questions so I can get to know them. And I got a couple of them here. One of the questions I ask, and you don't have to ask this question, stupidest question ever. What was your first car? What was your first car? Okay? That question there, everybody was quick to bring up. I had an 86 Cabriolet, you know, something stupid. I had a Chevy S10. I had a rusted out Ford truck, you know. We had all these things pop up. I could care less about the car. But the car came to the next question. What kind of car would you buy if you could buy? If you could buy a car today, what kind of car would you buy? And then you see the eyes light up, right? I opened the door there. Eyes light up. Oh, well, if you're going to buy that car, you'd need a job, right? What do you want to be when you grow up? Because at 19, 20, 25, some of these kids have no idea what they want to be when they're going to grow up. I look around the room, I got some 40 and 50-year-olds in here that have no idea what they want to be when they grow up. Am I wrong? Am I? Right? So here's what I want you to do. I want you to take 2 minutes around your table before we finish with the G part, and I want you to talk about this engage piece. I want you to talk about a question that you think you could use to ask to engage somebody from your list. So take a couple minutes, 2 minutes. All right, so I'm gonna bring us back here so I don't run us behind. From the audience, I want two examples. Raise a hand, give me an example of a question. Teresa. Okay, that's not bad. My wife always asks me, hey, where do you want to eat? Another one. What makes you happy? Ooh. What is happy? Right? Because happy is different for different people. George, I'm going to give you the last one. When did you plan your family? Ooh. For a young couple, that's a big one, right? Pressure's on. Do most people plan their families? Is what I'm asking. I mean, for a friend, I'm asking this question. Okay? All right. So let's get back to the topic at hand. We're going to finish with the letter G here, okay? The letter G. Give them a spiritual truth that is meaningful to you, or tell them the story. God's story of Jesus and our story with Jesus. I had a young lady who I know from work, comes in the office one day, and I've made it a habit, just about 99% of people sitting in my chair, I ask them, how you doing today? It's an icebreaker, right? And then they'll be like, good. I'm like, all right, tell me something new today. Tell me something that's happened in your life. Tell me something that's changed. Because I want more than just this quick blip. She looks me in the face, dead straight, and says, found out I got cancer. I don't know if I'm going to make it. And I was like, whoa. All right, next question. What's price of gas? No, I'm just kidding. I didn't do that. I did not do that, okay? Instantly, I felt God tugging me, right? tugging me, Nick, you need to ask this woman where she stands. And then I felt me saying, don't ask this woman. So we talk a little bit more. She gives me some details. Man, it's a rough surgery. But we'll see. She has a 20% chance of living. Wow, right? I like this woman. I've known her for 20 years. What do I have to explain to her now? Do you have a relationship with Jesus Christ? This is an awkward place to be, as my hands are in her mouth, right? Awkward. Good news is it's a one-way conversation, but it's an awkward place to be. I could have very easily, and I won't go into details, I could have very easily have just said, now is not the time or place, I can't do this. 2 minutes later, I feel God, do this. Nope. Do this. We go back and forth for probably 20 minutes during appointment. At the end of the appointment, we have the conversation. She says, yes, I have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And I said, are you secure in that relationship to know that if you were in the 80% of people who don't make this, are you okay? For her family, she was not. But for herself, she was. Hard thing to do. I took the opportunity. I prayed with her. And I'm going to tell you, I just sat up here and I just said what I did, but I'm going to tell you there's 100 times I didn't do it. There's 100 times that came across my shoulder in other situations and I didn't do it. Do it. Engage them. Tell them your story with God. Tell them his story of Jesus Christ, his son. Okay? So as we wrap up today, I hope that you realize when you read Scripture and you take a look at people in the Bible, there's way more to it than what we read. It is not just a simple name. And most people will just remember J.L. for driving a peg through Sisera's head. But this story is so much more. It's about God putting someone in the right place for just the right time. God has plans for all of us. When we choose to participate, there is no limit to what we can accomplish for him. Barak hesitated, and God moved Jael to the front line. God chose Jael, the Terminator, who was steady, tough, and ready for whatever he needed. This was not chance. This was God putting it into motion, years in the making. Okay? So I ask you today, are you allowing God to use you where you're at and put you where he needs you? Your right place, right time, moment. Okay, let's close in prayer. Dear Lord, Heavenly Father,